I am a human being and I killed human beings.
Before I knew it, I'd fired 4 shots at the door. I kept on shouting for Reva to phone the police.
Tests are underway to determine if a serial killer is on the loose in Centurion, Pretoria.
The dead won't bother you. It's the living you gotta worry about.
In South Africa, 71 people are murdered every day. These are the stories of Africa's killers and criminals and what it takes to catch them. My name is Paul Llewellyn, I'm a journalist and true crime filmmaker, and my co-host, as always, to discuss crime on the continent is Jared Labuschagne, the former cop and current head of LNS Threat Management, who led the investigative psychology section of the South African Police Service from 2001 until 2016. In his time there, he worked on over 300 serial murder and rape cases, and he is the Profiler. Please visit our YouTube page and subscribe, search Profiler Africa. Please do subscribe, and we highly recommend you listen to the podcast on YouTube too. We're available on Apple and Google Podcasts, SoundCloud and Spotify. Simply search Profiler. Please share your favorite link. You can engage with us on our social pages. Our Twitter and Instagram handle is @ProfilerAfrica, or you can email us profilerafricainfo@gmail.com. That's profilerafricainfo@gmail.com. So, a few weeks ago, we introduced you to Lieutenant Colonel Yanni De Lange, who has now retired from the police. He was a member of the police from way back in 1987, so was a part of the South African police for an amazing period and had an illustrious career there. Worked very closely with Gerard in the investigative psychology section for a number of years. And today we are lucky to have Yanni back with us, as we promised previously, to discuss a specific case that he worked on, and a very interesting one. Jared, how are you doing, first of all? Nice to see you again.
Yep, doing all right, thanks.
Are you well?
We're on the go, yeah.
Yes, the year is turning out to be a pretty interesting one, I think. Mm-hmm. Managing to find some interesting folks to talk to on the podcast. Please do suggest any specific episodes that you'd like us to talk about. We are going to kind of incorporate more and more of your input into the podcast as we try to evolve what it is that we do. I'd like to welcome Yanni back to the podcast again. Hi, Yanni. How are you?
Fine, yourself. Thank you very much.
Great. How's retirement going? How's the last couple of weeks of retirement been since we spoke last?
Still feeling like I'm on pension, on holiday.
Still feeling like he's on holiday. I think that's pretty much how retirement goes, isn't it? It's just like one big long holiday now. So we must check in 6 months' time. We'll check back in again, and hope maybe it's become work then. And so we're finding that you're more inclined to get back to investigating in some way, shape, or form. We're going to discuss a very interesting case today: the case of Anisha van Niekerk, the murder of Anisha van Niekerk. Where do we start with this one, guys? Who wants to kick us off?
Well, I think what I always found interesting is I typically would not really take much time off in December. And Yanni, I think you ever took time off in December. Yeah. And it was always interesting that there often seemed to be a December case, a kind of defined December. And what I always said was nice about it is typically because things have wound down, there's not much going on. Your people are kind of hanging around the office, you know, specifically when we were still at Serious and Violent Crime Head Office. So you've got lots of office braais. When I say office braai, I mean a braai in the actual office.
Indoors?
Indoors, yeah. It was, yeah. And and often a case would just come along that kind of people would just all be jumping onto because, you know, there's not much else that they're up to. And I think this was kind of one of those cases. We had one, I don't know if it was a year before or after this, where the woman was murdered who went to go help some people move some stuff, also in that general area,
Boskop,
and then they found the body. So this was, I think, one of those. And how did you get involved with this, Yanni?
The branch commander of Welbekind Police Station phoned me, and because I was previously working at Welbekind Police Station, he knows me, and he phoned me, he said, listen here, we found the body of a white female about 1.5 kilometers from the police station, and decomposed or starting decomposing, and they know I'm working on serial rape cases and serial murder cases, if I can come and help them. So I said, for sure, and I went to the crime scene.
Now, tell us a little bit, for our non-South African and non-Gauteng listeners, tell us a little bit about Welbekend.
Welbekend is a farming area between Babsfontein and Bronkhorstspruit. It's more plots and farms. There's no, the only two houses on Welbekend is the police station's houses. It's supposed to be that the farm area is the plus on Bekend. But because the post always came back from the post office, they changed the police station to Welbekend. So the only place, Welbekend, is only the police station. Oh. The surrounding areas is the farm on Bekend.
Which is, for those who don't speak of requirements, means unknown. So I think you once told me they would send post and it would be the post office would just 566 to the post office or unknown.
Mm.
So all the stuff would come back. You said, but why, you know, you're sending something to an unknown post office. But no, that's the town was called Onbekend or the farm was called Onbekend. So they then changed it to Welbekend, which means well-known.
Yes.
So, now, am I correct in saying that you have a history in this area?
Yes, I was the branch commander there from 1990 to 92.
Okay, so you know this community intimately.
Yes.
And you know kind of, so what are the typical kinds of crimes that you would have experienced?
No, it was mostly housebreakings, assault cases during weekends, small on farms housebreakings and stealing stuff. Some few cattle or sheep steal cases. But
murder's not typical.
No.
Okay. In South Africa, it's not just murder cases that pop up in December. It's also, we also seem to be famous in December for there being some idiot racist making some terrible comment on the internet that everyone, but then for you guys, obviously it was a case would pop up. So this was the 3rd of December in 2007, if I'm correct, the body was found. Where do we go from? Kick us off then. So where did you guys get started? You get called to this crime scene.
So I went straight to the crime scene, and the body was really removed when I came to the crime scene. But I found the crime scene photos later during the day, and the body was lying on a stomach. She was naked from her waist down, and started decomposing already, and. Only significant on a crime scene was about 12 meters from a crime scene, a pair of Ray-Bans was found next to the body, about 12 meters from the body. That was standing out for me because you can see it doesn't fit there.
Mm.
So then the race started to try to identify the victim because your investigating start from if you know who it is. So the body was removed post-mortem people, and I sent people from forensics to try to get the fingerprints from the body to try to identify them.
Just this time of the year, it's the beginning of December, it's the beginning of summer, it's hot. I imagine that Welbekend is particularly hot at this time of year. So just let's talk about when you arrive at, what are some of the first things you will do when you arrive on a crime scene? I mean, obviously, I would imagine that the local police have cordoned off the area and just kind of set the perimeter and are managing the space. What do you do when you walk onto the crime scene? And what are some of the realities when it comes to the level of decomposition at this time of year in particular?
Well, the first thing is that the crime scene must be photographed. And so you try not to walk onto the crime scene, not before the crime scene experts were there to doing the crime scene. They must first take the photos of the crime scene, then try to be there. There's only one way in, one way out, just not to disturb the surrounding areas. But because the body was starting to decompose already, and there was rain during those times, there was nothing else standing out on this crime scene except this pair of Ray-Bans.
Okay. What did you assume the time period to be that the body had been there from the amount of decomposition that, because I mean, I'm just looking at the photographs, the body looks pretty decomposed to me.
It was at least a week.
Okay.
From my experience, I thought it maybe at least a week or late or longer.
And do you recall who found the body?
Yes, it was a guy that went there to relieve himself next to the road. And he walked into the farm area, about 2 meters And then he saw I think he saw and he smelled the body.
Okay. So everything's photographed. The body is then removed to be, and you were at the point where now you were trying to identify who this person is.
Yes.
But at that point, I mean, did you know you were going to end up taking over the investigation?
No.
You were just there sort of assisting whoever was the docket carrier.
That's right.
Okay. So everyone understands again. So a local officer would have been running the case already, essentially, from the Valbekent station.
That's right.
Okay. And then you're called in to assist.
That's right, yes.
Okay. Identification, how did that process, how did we identify who the victim was?
So we tried to get the fingerprints from the body and running the fingerprints through our face, but we couldn't get any luck from there. So about a few days later, somebody phoned me from the station and said, listen, here, there's a guy yet at the station and said his sister is missing. And they want to take him to the body to show him the body. And I said, you can't take him to the body because there's nothing to show to them. So I said, only thing that you must do is let me get an ID number. So he phoned the mother, and the mother sent me the ID number. And through the ID number from Home Affairs, we identify as Anisha van der Kerk.
So that was his sister, the brother that was doing
this.
That's interesting because, I mean, if as we jump a bit forward, I don't want to ruin the sort of information. This is a relatively far distance from where the victim stayed. So, I mean, did he go to did he go to a whole bunch of police stations?
What happened is there was also a big bus up on this from the start of the investigation. She was reported missing in Kempton Park, where she stays. And they were supposed to send the missing person information to head office, but that didn't happen. So only in Kempton Park, at the local places, a photo was up as missing persons and everything. And then the local newspapers put an article about the body that we found. And a whole story about this young girl was found a kilometer from the police station, decomposed. And he saw the article in the newspaper about a body was found at the Albuquerque police station. That's how we come around.
Okay.
And that's how we get the ID numbers and we identified her as Anisha van der Kerk.
Would that have been because you then got her fingerprints from Home Affairs?
Yes.
And asked them to compare them to the crime scene prints.
That's right.
Fingerprints. Okay.
Okay. So that's nice that happens because I've always in my mind had the kind of Home Affairs fingerprints database as not accessible to the police, but it is. If you know the right people to call.
It's not official.
Yeah.
If you know, but you yes. got you know the person to call up. Like,
but I think to identify bodies,
previous...
you can't, they will allow the fingerprints to be run through their database, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, it's done, yeah.
But otherwise, officially no.
Officially yes. no.
For any other reason.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But unofficially sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, maybe. Okay, fine. I just want to put this down to you had your ways and your means of accessing that database, which were perfectly acceptable at the time. What were some of the other standout things from the body on the scene? I mean, the fact that I know Jared often speaks about a body being found that's partially naked or completely naked, that there immediately start to be an assumption of some kind of sexual component there. Were there things like that that stood out about the body itself from the crime scene?
Yes, and also the whole face was smashed up.
Okay.
So the whole skull was broken. And then my point of view was also that she wasn't murdered there because there was no scuffle around it, like there was any scuffle around the crime scene. It looked like she was just dumped there. We're talking about a dumping site. So this looked like to me to a dumping site.
Okay.
She was murdered somewhere else and just left there.
So there was no blood evidence or blood spatter or disturbance in the immediate vicinity.
No.
Okay. Okay, then where do you go from there? So you've got an identified body. You know this is Anisha. Is this where you now start to find out more?
Yeah, so then it came out that she was reported missing on the 25th of November.
Okay.
2007, and we found her on the 3rd December. So it was now 8-9 days that she was meant missing. But from the beginning, the brother told me the story that the stepfather was last seen with her, and he said he dropped her off by her friend's house, and that doesn't sound correct to them, or something is not up with the story that they've been telling. And then, so from the beginning, something was not right for us with the story he was telling. So I've contacted parents and I said, listen, yeah, I want to meet you. And then they said, but they want to come to my office. I said, no, I want to come to your house. So what I've done, I've organized with crime scene management to follow me to her house where she was staying, to speak to the parents, and then also to inform the parents, because then the parents didn't know that we ID'd her already.
Okay.
So I went there also to do the death notification. But our crime scene people was waiting outside for me. So after I told the mother, listen, you know, we found your daughter, it is your daughter, she was found next to the road, everything. So then I said to him, listen, you know, I want to tell me where she sleep and where she stayed. And they showed me the room. I said, then I want to do forensics on her bedroom. And
so this was the mother and the stepfather present, yes, at this point.
Yes. And I told the stepfather from the beginning, you know, you're the last person with her. So unfortunately for you, you are going to be investigated to see, can I exclude you from everything?
Yeah.
And he said, no problem. So while we were busy, crime scene people came in, and then he told me the story that they all went. It was a Sunday afternoon. They have a bride at the house. She was in a bikini, swimming at the swimming pool, and then they decided they're going out to club for the night, to a restaurant for a dance and eat. And she and him will drive with the motorcycle. The mother will follow them in his bucket.
And this isn't close by where they stay. This was like on the other side of Johannesburg.
So
where they were going out.
The place where they're going to go have drinks. And, yes. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So his story was they went there at the club, eat there and dance, and she was dancing to each other with his stepdaughter. She's 19 years old, 20 years, 19. And so when they left, the mother left before them. You know, they left together, but the mother left and they were on a motorcycle going home. But when the mother picked up at home, he wasn't there. He only arrived later. And when she asked him, but where is my daughter? He said, I drop off a friend's house. And when she found a friend, the friend said, but where did he drop me off? Because I'm not staying where he say I'm staying. Mm-hmm. Anisha know that I moved. So that was bells for us.
Okay.
So I asked him, where's the clothes that he was wearing? So he gave me his motorcycle helmet, her helmet, all his clothes he was wearing, and he was also bringing her jacket that she was wearing. He brought the jacket back and the helmet back. Okay. So he dropped off without the helmet, without the jacket, and her purse, with her cell phone, with her cigarettes, were at the house.
So he also had those? I didn't know. Okay.
Okay. Just before we carry on, just tell us a little bit about Anisha. What was she?
She was 3 months before this event. The mother and father get married, and the stepfather.
Okay.
But she was in London, working in London. So she came back for a sister's wedding, which was supposed to happen the week after she went missing.
Okay.
So she was missing when the wedding went place.
Oh, yeah.
So she came only met the stepfather that week. But she was here.
Okay, so this was a relatively new relationship.
New relationship. Everything was new. So okay. She never. Then I asked him that I want the jacket and helmets. I want to take it for forensics. And he said, no problem, you can take it. Then I said to him, also, I want you to take off your T-shirt, your shirt. I was going to examine you myself, check if you've got anything. And he got a one scratch mark on his back on his back. And I asked him, what is this scratch mark? He said to me, no, I was catching the roses that scratched my back. And then I said to him, but I want that to be also examined by a medical doctor to give me a full report on your. He said, no problem, I will go. And he went with gave him a detective, took him to a doctor to do a full examination, took photos of it. That's done. And I sent all these things to forensics, and now you must wait.
Did he give you a formal statement?
He gave me a formal statement.
Hmm.
Exactly what I'm telling you, the same thing, how he went there.
Just take, this is so the gentleman's name is Gerard Stefanus Williamson. Tell us a little bit, you know, just describe him. How old is he? You know, and what is his general demeanor like when? So he seems quite casual.
He was very casual. I can't remember his age, but I think he was in his mid-50s.
Okay.
Working from home, doing selling car parts to for somebody else, like a rep. And okay. His bucky was there, what he was using with all his tools, with all his equipment that he was selling to people. But the story what I got from her from the beginning was, he's the guy that I'm talking about, the girls, the guy with a tassie. The guy that comes with you with a tassie, he's only got a toothbrush and maybe a pair of pants.
Yeah.
He got nothing on his name.
Coming into the relationship.
Coming into the relationship with nothing.
Okay.
So I always talk the guy with a tassie, then you must run.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was his story. But the first thing you start, I got his ID number, so I draw his profile from our records, and then all the lights go on. This guy was involved in rape cases, in assault cases.
Of people he knew cases. And people who were strangers or family, I mean, like...
Yeah. Family members, his girlfriends, his fiancés, girlfriends, the children that he molested, he was charged for. I'm talking about 19, 20 cases.
And so Jane, who was Anisha's mother, would not have been, was not aware of any of this criminal background. Not aware
of anything of this, nothing.
And had he served time, had he been incarcerated?
No, never.
He had been found guilty of one, a couple
he
of
was
them.
He was found guilty of a couple of it, but like fines. You will get the 500 rand fine or something like that. So it's, I think it's less. Most of the cases, unfortunately, was withdrawn by the parents. The parents will open the cases to 5-year girls in the senior. When you have a bride, you will come in, you fondled me. Some of the mothers didn't believe the children. Some of the mothers will open cases, but then you will withdraw the cases. They said, no, we don't want to get the children to go through this drama again with court cases and stuff.
But I mean, where there's smoke, there's fire. I mean, we always say, if you've been arrested 20 times for assault, but you've never been convicted, that... You have an assault problem. I mean, I've never been arrested for assault. I'm sure you haven't, Paul, Yanni. So even things that don't go over to you being prosecuted, like domestic violence, how many times do you see people open up cases and it gets withdrawn by the girlfriend or the wife the next day? So a lot of things do get withdrawn. Doesn't mean it didn't happen. So that's definitely a huge warning sign, even though he's got not convictions necessarily or lots of them.
But the lesson that we're going to take out from this little part of the discussion is, man with a tussie, make sure you do a little bit of investigation into where this guy comes from and find out more than just about the fact that he owns a toothbrush.
So it sounds like by now you've taken over this case.
Yes. Not on paper, but I took the docket.
Mm. Which was unusual for us because that was not our job. We were there as an advisory service to detectives. Sometimes we advised a hell of a lot, sometimes we didn't. But there were those rare occasions like this one, I think Quarry, that the we Quarry. Worked on, the stalker case that we worked on, where it just kind of molded drift, where it just kind of unfolded in that way.
Yes.
That it would have been very impractical for us not to have and to try and start running around arranging another investigating officer. It just would, and it wasn't necessarily because the IO was a bad IO. It just kind of sometimes we had the time and resources, and it just
Yes, but we could have never told our superiors that we're doing it because it was not on.
So as you say, we typically left the docket on. I remember the stalker case. I think I had it actually transferred to Captain Mike von Ott, who's very well known now, the Oscar Pistorius guy, investigator, who took over the investigation. You know, I had my stalker case on his name, and this you just left on the IO's name.
Yes.
And often the detectives, I mean, they've got so many cases, they're quite happy if someone's going to do the work for them. They're not too worried.
Would it also be, though, that kind of in your gut you know that there's, you kind of got a sense pretty quickly that you're going to solve this one?
No, and you can't delay.
This one was,
you got to run.
This one was like, I think this Thursday after we ID'd, I know it's you.
Okay. Okay. Now, did you get that sense speaking to him? I mean, can you, when you, I mean, you've said previously that interviewing is not necessarily your thing, but and if you're getting somebody back to the station, perhaps a Gerard or somebody would be doing the, but obviously you're interviewing people on a regular daily basis, etc. You got the sense from this guy before you'd seen his criminal background. You got the sense that there's nervousness here. Were there tells?
Yeah, but I was all my years is before I go to a guy, and I got his ID number. I'll do his profile, so I'll see his background, and I will go with information to him. So if he tell me a story, I know he's lying to me already. So it's. I don't ask him about all the stories because then I went out and to draw all those dockets. I went to all those places to get all those dockets and to go through those dockets and see what he was doing previously.
Of previous arrests or cases, yeah.
Yes.
Because you know that you want to get a pattern of behavior here.
And also, at this point, I mean, you might know in your heart it's him.
Yes.
But you don't have anything to arrest him at that point.
You must prove it, yes.
So that in a way gives the time to go search the background a bit more, et cetera, and... Yeah. And that's all right. I mean, we always say that, you know, you shouldn't be interviewing a suspect unless you know a little, as much as you can under the circumstances about that person.
Okay. Well, that's a good lesson to learn right there. Do your research before you sit down with somebody as much as you can.
No, for sure.
All right. Okay.
Because Tinder dates also. If you're going to go on a Tinder date, you can Google search him, Facebook, if you get his name or his phone number. See what you can find out about the person.
Yeah, especially if a guy called Gerard comes up on your Tinder.
especially.
Okay, so where to next then?
So, during the post-mortem, the whole skull was broken down and there was nothing left. And that haunted me. And I said, I want to do something with that. And then I phoned Prof. Simon and asked him, can't we do something with it? He said, yes. Bring the body back to me and I will send it to the University of Pretoria to build a skull for me. So the body was sent back from coming to Pretoria and the skull or the pieces was sent to the University of Pretoria and they built a whole skull for me to can see where all the injuries was on the skull.
Okay, so that wasn't about identification. No. That was to go, let's look at what happened to this body.
Because, I mean, things you can often see, like, if there was multiple blows, you can often see which was the first or what kind of object, maybe. But because she wouldn't have been autopsied at Pretoria watching Prof. Simon, he would have probably said, okay.
Maybe there's another weapon used. Maybe there's a knife stab wound or a bullet or something.
At the post-mortem, the doctor who's done the post-mortem said, maybe she was shot with a shotgun. Okay. And then that confuses me now because... You can't tell me maybe. I must know what's going on.
Yeah.
So that's when I went to Prof. Simon and he helped me with this. So that was sent to Pretoria, but now you must wait. It's December. You must wait. Yeah. So then I draw his cell phone was confiscated and draw all his stuff on his cell phone. And then I found a photo of him with a pair of Ray-Bans on his cell phone, took him by his wife while he was driving in his car. And I took that photo and send it to ID kit people to try to check for me if the Ray-Bans that we got on the crime scene match the Ray-Bans on the photo. And it matched. But unfortunately, it's only Ray-Bans is a common glasses. So that's one thing that ticked. It's one thing that you can put in the box.
Mm.
So that was a nice thing. So then we got all this,
But I think, that's going that extra mile. Like you say, you build up all these little things, they become big things.
Sure.
And I think a lot of people just dismiss it like, oh, but you know, unless you can say it's his specific Ray-Bans because there's a unique mark on it, there's no point in doing that. And, you know, you never know how the investigation is going to turn and how such tiny little things, even if you were to interview him and you can say, those Ray-Bans we know are the same kinds you wear, that might be enough for him to confess, let alone... adding to all this weight of evidence if you do go to court or to convince the prosecutor for an arrest. So circumstantial kind of stuff really does add up in the end.
This is that, again, what we spoke about in our previous discussion where you talk about to be a good detective, you've got to be creative. You've got to think out of the box because there is not a Ray-Ban forensic specialist who only... and who regularly looks at Ray-Bans as part of investigations. But when you... acquire certain pieces of evidence, You as a detective need to be able to see the potential in that piece of evidence, and then find somebody in your investigative forensic universe that's able to take that piece of evidence and take it to the next level.
And it's no skin off your nose. It's not like you have to not do that. So you just got to take that and give it to, like in this case, you did the identikits people who will be able to do that comparison, the skull to these. So I'd always say to detectives, it's not your money. No. It's not your time. It's not your effort.
Yeah.
Just your effort is to find the person and take it there. That's it.
You're the person who's at the central person who is creating those connections and bringing in the expertise you need. Which is why I always say
the evidence could all be there, but if you don't have a good detective to put it all together, it's not going to be used. Mm. So that's why the detective is so paramount in actually the success of a case, no matter how much forensic evidence you've got lying around. Mm.
Yeah. And also, we check for DNA and for fingerprints. There's no fingerprints, but we check for DNA. But because it was lying in the felt for those 10 days or 9 days, no DNA was found. So we first checked for that, and unfortunately, there was nothing. And then we done.
Exactly. You go for the kind of standard stuff first, and then as you discover not typical evidence, you start to apply more creative ideas to the process.
Yes.
Okay.
So then I went to get all the previous cases of him, all the previous dockets, and starting to interview all those people again, his ex-wife, his ex-children. Oh, okay. So there came a lot of stuff out. But,
and I think we even, was it like Christmas Eve? If I recall correctly, that year we were in Kempton Park interviewing, I think, friends of his for you to take a statement. So I mean, that just Christmas Eve kind of doing that stuff.
During this time in this news article, it was in the newspaper, and then it came out that Anisha was identified. The body was identified as Anisha, and she's now married to Gerard. Then I receive a phone call from a girl in Kempton Park. She's 22 years old. Beautiful blonde girl. She said, "It's him." I said, "What do you mean it's him?" She said, he molested me when I was a child. When I was 5 or 8 years old, my parents never believed me."
So she wasn't one of those cases that were on his register? Okay. Well.
And then that's the girl that we went to interview on Christmas Eve.
Okay, okay. So this is all about just expanding upon that kind of character sketch.
She gave me a full statement, and her parents were friends of Gerard, and they was at a braai, and she said while the parents were outside and she was sleeping, he came into her room, molested her, and she told her mother, and her mother said, "No, it's..."
So what you have here, then you're going, well, we've got a serial offender here who is essentially potentially the first time that he's evolved to murder.
Yes. So then we done all those things. You and Almony were in Durban to interview his parents.
Yeah.
And so they done that for me.
It was interesting, just on that. I mean, normally I think if you go to someone's parents and you say your son has committed a horrific crime, there's a bit of an element of, are you sure? There's no, I can't be, not my son. They just like, And they didn't push it. And I was like, afterwards, said to Almony, it's like, it's very interesting that they aren't arguing at all. I see, you know, it's kind of the longer, he's a very good investigating officer, and they just didn't at 1 minute say, couldn't be my son. There's no way. Are you absolutely sure? Nothing. And I thought, wow, that, I don't know, just kind of says a lot to me.
Absolutely.
There was no attempt.
So where were the pair? Where was he from?
Well, they were down just south of Durban, somewhere like Toti or something in that kind of area, if I recall correctly, back then. I mean, this was, you know, many years ago.
Okay. But talking about his interview, so we called him for an interview, but I asked Elmer to do the interview, and we put him on a lathe.
Layered voice analysis, which is kind of like a lie detector, sort of, for lack of a better word, but it analyzes what you're talking in the process of a conversation, whereas a polygraph, you've got like 3 questions you can ask.
Mm.
But a layered voice analysis, you can have like a recording of this right now. You can run it through the program, and it would give you sort of indicators. Here, the person's not telling the truth. Here, they are, etc. So it's kind of a modernish form of polygraph, but not using the same things that the polygraph uses.
Okay.
So Almery took his statement and all those things, and then she pointed out to me all the places where he was lying in his statements.
Okay.
But we never told him about what we know about him. We just ask him the simple questions and tell us the story about your...
And he's not arrested.
No, he's not arrested. That was in December.
How do you and Al-Marie just kind of interchange on a case? Because you're both kind of contributing where you need to. And, you know, how did that...
Just depends.
You know, again, just because you're kind of working together 9 to 5 every day, just a case of, okay, we got this to do today, you go do this, I'll go do that.
Yeah, and I said, specifically before Yanni joined, I mean, it was typically me and Elmery kind of offered, because, well, I think there was 3 of us with me and Elmery at the time. So it just kind of depended on the day, the caseload. Okay. If she was going to go down to Durban, I might just go with her, that she's not going alone.
So it could just as easily have been you interviewing him as Elmery. It's just a case that you guys are a team and you're just kind of assigning tasks as you go, essentially.
Yeah, sometimes it happens. I'll be in Durban and you'll be in Cape Town and Elmery will be in Joburg. So it's...
just makes sense. Okay, all right. So now we're with the interview.
Him and Almari said to me, this guy is lying through his teeth with all these stories. And so then we interview the mother again, Jane, and ask her about his Ray-Bans. She said to me, no, but she asked him about the Ray-Bans, and he told her that night he lost his Ray-Bans. When he came home, his Ray-Ban was missing, and he bought himself a pair of new Ray-Bans.
So then, I mean, for me, that's then again that little bit of you at least trying to say these are the same Ray-Bans. That statement now, that kind of very sort of perhaps generic circumstantial stuff becomes a lot more specifically relevant.
Yeah. And then it comes out that after he allegedly dropping her off, coming home, telling her that he dropped her off a friend's house, and she phoning the friend said, but I'm not staying there. And she was phoning everybody and looking for her daughter. And they went to bed to sleep that night. During the night, she wake up, but he was gone. So Gerard was out that night with his bucky. And he came back later during the early hours of the morning. He said, no, he went out to look for her. So we got that story that he went out with the bucky, not on his bicycle, was on his bike. And so then in the early of February the next year, I was informed that forensics that in the helmet at the... on a screw of the visor of the helmet, there was a drop of blood found that belongs to somebody, but they battled to get the DNA out, to extract the DNA. So they ran it a few times, and eventually on the 25th of February, they informed me that the lot of blood found in the visor belongs to Anisha van der Kerk.
And this was his helmet, or the helmet he said she'd been wearing?
The helmet that she was wearing.
Okay.
So that I decided it was enough for me. I'm going to arrest him now. Without a warrant, I went. But during those months, I was talking to the son the whole time. And of course, the son was working with him. As
the son of Gerard, the suspect? No. Or Anisha's brother?
Anisha's brother.
Okay.
Was at that time working for him. And so he was... my information informant from the house, what is going on at the house, because the mother was still believing that he's not involved in everything.
Oh, she was still absolutely and we didn't, in honeymoon.
We didn't inform the Licinia, we think it's him. So we told the son, Licinia, I called the son and said, Licinia, we think it's him. And he said also from the beginning, I think it's him. So I said, Licinia, we're busy, check with your mother and... we will inform you day when Mike week. And that morning I phoned him. I said, listen, yeah, where are you? He said, no, we are still at the house. I said, stay there. I'm on my way. But if we arrive there, you must just stand one side because we're going to come to arrest him.
Okay.
So myself and Morneida Toy went that morning and arrested him and told him, listen, yeah, I arrest you for the murder of Anisha van der Kerk.
And what was his attitude?
No, he said, why? You're a wrong person and blah, blah, blah. It can't be. Then I know he's got firearms. So I said, I want the safe keys. I want the firearms. So I took the firearms away from him and confiscated the firearms. And we arrested him, took him straight to Velbekin police station.
Was that partly because you thought a firearm might have been used? Had you gotten those results back saying, look, this was not a shotgun bullet or this, it was, or was it just because you thought...
just because there's firearms.
Yeah.
And it was on his name. And the only thing that he got extra is the firearms.
Yeah.
So I took the firearms away.
Okay. And what does that mean now as far as, How long can you hold him for before prosecuting or before laying a charge against him?
48 hours.
Okay. So this is the start of that 48-hour
period. Yes. So the Monday he was arrested, took him to the Welbekind police station, and now the wife is phoning. You make a big mistake. It's not him.
Because what is her view? I mean, how does she describe him as a person?
Well, he was the nicest guy. He was making the food, washing the dishes, washing the clothes. He was the best guy on earth.
Well, I suppose you've got nothing. You've got to try and stay in someone's good books.
But her son was in... Well, he obviously then wasn't, at this time, challenging her too much on her point of view.
No. Because she was only married for 3 months to him, so yeah. I don't think she knows him that much. Yeah. And the son was also not staying with them. He was also, he also came in from London. So he was also only a few months in Pretoria.
Was he not concerned about the safety of his mother with this man suspecting?
I was concerned about that.
Yeah.
And,
but imagine they stayed. He would have been, yeah. But there's only so much you can do if your mother has kind of got the blinkers on.
Yeah. So we arrested him on that Monday and took him to the station, and I took his warning statement, and he still said, it's not me. You got the wrong person, blah, blah, blah. So Monday said to me, what we must do, we must take his cigarettes away. So we put him in the cell and we took his cigarettes away. And at the Albuquerque police station, only on Wednesdays there's court. And there's local court that comes from Bronkhorstspruit, the prosecutor and the magistrate, come to the police station. And at the police station.
Oh, the whole court at the police station.
At the police station, there's a court room just for, because it's a small court. And after he was, and I charged him on that on Wednesday morning, and for the murder of Anisha, and he went for his first appearance in court.
Did he have a lawyer yet? Did he get a lawyer?
No, that guy at the time, he's not got a lawyer, nothing yet. And so when we were finished, that his case was remanded for 7 days. And when he came out of the court, he said to me, I want to talk to you. I said, okay, but I'm still... take him to my office. I said, but you must still... I must warn you of your legal rights you got. Things. He said, no.
He's still in custody.
Still in custody.
The station. He's not sent to the...
No,
he's
still at the station. He said to me, no... I want to confess. I said, but now, okay, now I must stop you again. I must warn you about your rights, everything. But if you want to do, I can organize for you to do it in parcel, pointing out and everything. He said, I'm willing to do it. I just want to get it off my chest.
So again, just to recap for those of you who hadn't listened to us before, maybe the pointing out is where a person, for example, wants to confess. You have a couple of options. You can either say, we're going to take you to a magistrate, and then you'll tell that magistrate everything you want to, and magistrate goes through all the legal warnings, were you threatened, were you promised anything? Or you can get an independent officer, meaning someone from the rank of, say, a captain, when we say officer, upwards, commissioned officer, who doesn't know anything about the case, didn't attend the crime scene, hasn't read the docket, nothing, who then arrives, and basically you hand over this guy to that officer, and then he says... goes through all, again, the legal requirements. Were you threatened? Were you promised anything? Blah, 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 blah. And he says, right, I don't know anything about this case. I believe you want to show me something or tell me something. And then the guy would say, yes, let's get in the car. I want to take you here. I want to take you there. Show you this, show you that. And confess, or that's usually what happens, and also show you things. So it's a really great tool to use in court if the person doesn't plead guilty, because he's shown you things that only the suspect would know. And, of course, said things that, because that officer wasn't involved, the officer shouldn't know. And that's what he's now agreed to actually do.
And all of that information is by the book. It's legally sound and solid and will hold up.
It's done properly.
Court.
It's fantastic. And I haven't come across anybody else in the world that does it in the same way. The Americans will sometimes do a walkthrough, but the detective does it with the suspect. So I don't know how evidentially. We're in South Africa, we do it this way so that you can't argue, but you're the detective. You took me to the scene.
Yeah.
You told me. You know what happened. You've written everything down that you said. It's not my words. So this is a great way of, if it's done properly, you can show that this person, the people doing it, weren't contaminated by other information.
It makes you think about those cases like something like a Green River case in the States where you've seen, you know, they find the guy and then they take him out. So you're saying that chances are that they're not doing it kind of, it's not as independent potentially.
I mean, it's a great way to also to try and avoid false confessions, because you can't take people to a crime scene if you to that specific spot, specifically a crime scene out in the felt. I mean,
even if the bully cops were saying it's 2 kilometers down and in the bush by 2 meters, you're never going to get that right if you weren't actually at the scene. Yeah, so it really is a great way also to rule out false confessions.
So I phoned Captain Heinrich Verlude and he agreed to do the pointing out for me. So Captain Verlude came in and took Gerard from us. And
just want to make sure, not me.
Yes.
And Gerhard. Gave him all his legal stories, and then off they went. And now he must now wait and see if everything happens together. So now you wait at the station and hope he points the right places.
Yeah.
A lot of hours later, they arrive back at the station, and then they must first do all the paperwork again, sign, take photos of everything, book him back into the station. And then Andre came to me and said, no, this is the story that he tells me. He tells me they went with the bike from the restaurant. They stopped next to a dirt road to smoke. And then there was an argument between them, and then he killed her. He left her there, went back home, told the story to the wife about dropping off. And later at night, he went with the bucky, took the body of her.
From where he initially left it.
Where he left her, initially left her next to Kempton Park. Drove to Welbekind, over the fence, and dropped the body there.
So did you have a crime scene with any evidence?
No.
Did you find any evidence at the murder location?
No.
So he did point out that murder location in the process.
So from there, he said he went back again and took a clothes. And if that clothes he took back to their house and burn it in their briar. And
where they normally bury meat.
Yes, they normally bury meat. Burn her clothes, and that is his story.
Would you? That sounds like he's trying to evade, trying to not own up to the sexual component.
Yeah, sure.
Is that?
Yes.
I mean, you want my opinion? He tried something. She said, bugger off. I do agree. He probably said, let's just stop and have a smoke.
Yeah.
Okay. And I pretty much think he tried and he didn't get his way.
Or did sexually assault her.
He didn't get his way, so he forced his way.
Yeah.
And
Okay. Did you find anything? Did that lead you then to take a look at the bride?
Oh, but it was still
three months later,
there was nothing there.
And they'd used it.
And they used it again for a prize.
You know, so I mean, what a horrific thought the mother just
these are those kind of morbid aspects of a case where you're like...
So at that night of the mother was just phoning me and said, we can't be. And then I went back to that house and informed her, listen, we arrested him. And I got his Ray-Bans. And I showed the Ray-Bans. I think it's the only time that she started believing that we got something.
Yeah.
And you told her that, listen, he did a point, and she still not believe.
No, but then she started to believe it. Yes, no, she started believing. When I told her, he pointed us at everything. That's why he was out that night with the bucky. He went to move the body. Then she started believing what you're telling Tom. Mm.
And how does her demeanor shift there? Because it's almost like somebody kind of starting to realize they were a part of a cult or something, isn't it?
She was devastated for months. Told today she's very disappointed about the story.
Yeah, because you don't know who you're inviting into your life, and if you trust them, and then suddenly that trust is broken.
This is my fault because this is a guy I brought into the home. Exactly. Did this to my daughter. Which is not obviously fair on her to feel that way, but sure. I can imagine that as a parent, that's what you would feel.
Yeah, the trauma for sure.
Did she ever speak to him? I don't want to jump too far ahead. Did she ever again after this go and speak to him and say?
No, but his ex-wife went. Ex-wife and his own daughter went to speak to him at the cells, and then he confessed to them.
This before he told you, listen, I want to confess.
No, it's after he confessed.
Okay.
After he confessed. I think that was that Wednesday. I think it was the Thursday. Yeah, this day after the confession, they went to the cells to
Bobo Kent.
Yes.
I want to go back to that, to the skull reconstruction as well. So when would you have gotten that back, and did you deduce anything from that reconstruction?
They gave him a report on it and said what they think happened. So they said something, it must be like a big rock of something that was used to break the whole skull. Because I was thinking maybe the helmet was used. But Prof. Simon also said, no, the helmet wasn't, because there was no damage on the helmet. Mm. So we don't think, we know it's not the helmet. It must be something hard of it. And he said to a pointing out officer that he used a rock. But you couldn't find anything on the scene to corroborate with that.
Oh, I see. Mm. Okay, so a murder weapon was never entirely ascertained. No. But it was that head trauma that killed her.
Yes.
Okay.
And of course, they couldn't determine rape because of the extent of time that the body was decomposing for. Yeah. But I mean, naked from the waist down.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to draw some very clear conclusions from that.
For sure. Well, yeah, and I mean, also the actual, the mortal wound sound like you get, he's getting the added benefit from his perspective of covering up an easy identifier, or dealing with an easy identifier. Maybe that's also a part of, or potentially, would you have thought that? Is he trying to kind of mask who the victim is initially?
Yeah. I mean, where was the destruction? The front of the face? Or the, okay. But I'm also just wondering, he's transporting that body after the murder to the Velbekind. Was there anything on his bucky forensically? Yeah.
No, nothing.
Okay.
His bucky was clean, and it was full of, when we went there, it was full of equipment and stuff they're selling it. So it, there was nothing on forensic. Okay. We checked it for forensic, but we didn't find anything.
Mm. Okay, so now he's locked up. How the trial? Then now we move to actually getting this guy locked up.
So the next day on the Thursday, I asked if he'll do a full confession through a magistrate.
So he's done the pointed out, but you want to back it up with a confession in front of a magistrate. Yes.
So the next day we took him for a full confession to Callendon Court through a magistrate, and he told the whole story again.
And did it match basically the pointing out?
Match everything what we got on the pointing out, 100%. And
so this doesn't then need to go to a long trial, does it? I mean, how does this then kind of go through the process? Is this like, here, judge, here's all his confessions. He's pled guilty. Next day, you get him.
Well, under normal circumstances, Yanni's going to tell you what actually happened.
Yeah.
Just but for the listener, you know, you only use a confession or a pointing out. That's obviously at the moment in time he feels, I'm so guilty, I want to tell you what happened. But, you know, when you actually then, a month or two goes by, you're getting ready for whatever. Oh, no, I've changed my mind. But now I've got this bloody confession. So I'm going to have to say that the guy's threatened me, forced me, whatever.
Yes.
So you only actually, if a guy continues to say, I'm going to plead guilty, then his lawyer would draw up what we call a proper guilty plea in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act, which is done in a certain way with the assistance of the lawyer. You have to acknowledge certain things, and it's signed by this person. That's a guilty plea.
Yes.
Then you don't need the confession. You don't need the pointing out, because that guilty plea compiled by your lawyer supersedes then any other document. And that's enough then to say, right, we're not going to have a trial. Boom, you're guilty. But typically what happens in other cases is the guy changes his mind because he realizes, yeah, it's actually quite not so nice being in a cell or be going to prison and or whatever. And they decide, no, I'm not going to plead guilty. Then you have to start calling all the witnesses. And, of course, one of those pieces of evidence would definitely be that either the confession to the magistrate or the pointing out becomes a crucial evidence. But that's when the person says, no, I've changed my mind.
Mm. So was he a changed my minder? What happened in this instance?
No, that was the Friday morning. I got a phone call from the police station. He hung himself in a cell, committed suicide.
Okay. How do you feel about that when a perpetrator does something like that?
Well, the case is closed. in my career, it happens a few times.
Okay.
So there was your guy that committed suicide. The Mori guy was murdered.
But they did it after they were found guilty eventually. You know, the stalker guy did it after his conviction. Mori Mori guy, I think he was convicted.
Yes. The guy from Rustenburg, he was in hospital after they shot him.
Mm-hmm.
And he escaped from prison, hanging himself outside the gate. So it's, there was a few cases in my career that guys commit suicide.
Because it's always a funny question, because it's, you know, I think if it's after the trial, when the facts are there, the families have got the best answers they're going to get.
Yes.
I don't really care if a guy commits suicide. I think in this case, what I think is good from our point of view, he did a confession, he did a pointing out. There's very little questions the family could have. Besides, but why did you do it?
Yeah.
You know, we know what he did, and he's owned it up. I did this. This is how it played out. I'm not going to have sleepless nights about that. I think if he did it before, then it's one of those things like you bugger.
Yeah.
Because now the family is still going to always have that those naggers as to, but was it really him?
Mm.
Or, you know, you still leave scope for parents and families' minds to wonder. Here, I think he kind of closed off those gaps. So, you know, I'm not going to have sleepless nights. But under circumstances, I feel like if you do it before the trial, you're robbing the family of that opportunity to get the facts put on record for themselves. You know, not court record.
So I mean, what really stands out from, again, with these, how often do we come across these cases where it's just, again, some really interesting, creative kind of detective work that has been applied? I mean, this case, like you say, was solved in how many days did you wrap this up, do you think? I mean, really in a kind of, you know, practically, it was a few days that you were pretty sure you had the guy, and then it was a case of just doing the work to kind of, and that took that takes a few months to get through the process. But yeah, I mean, essentially here again, it's in those initial few days finding those key pieces of evidence, being creative in about how you're going to apply kind of your detective work to those pieces of evidence, and then getting it all wrapped up. This must be one of those cases that, when you talk about the December cases, gives you the opportunity to kind of like celebrate Christmas Day with a little bit more of a I deserve this day.
But after he hanged himself, the case is not over yet, because he must still go to court.
Okay.
He must still do an inquest
on his death.
On his death.
I see.
Which wouldn't have been, I mean, that's not you to investigate, that would be someone separate. Eh?
No, okay. Inquest on her name.
Oh, on her. Oh, sorry. On her. Okay.
So we done an inquest on her, because the whole docket must still go to the prosecutor, to the magistrate, to decide what's even if he done in this case.
Okay.
So we call it an inquest, and it's eventually a J56 must be issued by the magistrate. So in this case, a formal inquest was held. So all the statements was read into the court dockets, court records.
Mm.
So, and eventually the magistrate said, I believe that Gerard
Williamson
was responsible for the murder of Anisha Faneker and his son.
So every death has to have a court conclusion, you can put it that way. Mm. That is either with a court case with an arrested suspect, a trial in other words, or like you say, you in this case, or in a case where you can't solve it, you've done all your investigative stuff, it still goes for an inquest. So there's some court decision or conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
The police can't just close it off and file it and put it away. I mean, imagine that, actually.
So until that happens, any docket is open.
Yeah, and even then...
Murder case.
And even then, I mean, 5 years down the line, you might get further information in an unsolved case saying, actually, this is the person. And then, of course, you can still go to trial with it. So this is just that there's nothing left hanging in the hands of the police. I suppose you can look at it that way.
Okay.
And, of course, his death also has to have
an inquest. Yeah, there's two inquests.
And it's a nice process for the family as well, as far as, you know, getting some real... concrete closure and that sense of justice.
Because a court can say at an inquest, Mr. X must be charged for this crime.
Yes.
That's another outcome. Not in this case because he's dead, but you know, they could look at it and go, I feel that you must charge Mr. So-and-so for the murder of this person. And then, of course, a trial would be held for that purpose.
Okay. I think this is one of those memorable cases, again, just because of the great investigative work done on it. But what stands out for you from this particular case, you know, when you look at it in the context of your work?
I always tell the people, it's, again, teamwork. It's not me. It's getting the right people at the right places that helped me. So it was crime scene management, doing the fingerprints, doing the crime scene. It was forensics, doing the DNA for me. Mm-hmm. It was Ariki doing... Comparison for me. The cyber to download the cell phones.
Anthropology, friends
of anthropology. University of Pretoria that helped me with the skull. Heinrich with the pointing out. And then the magistrate doing the confession. So it's everybody getting the right people to help you. At yourself, you can't do everything. It's no problem. It's no way.
But also the thing is, you knew about forensic anthropology, but the average detective at a little station somewhere probably, unless the forensic pathologist doing the autopsy says, I suggest we can do this, or we can send this to, wouldn't even know that this kind of a resource is accessible to them, or might not even know, where can I get a cell phone back then? You know, where can I get a cell phone downloaded? So it also is, a lot of people, it's good detectives who also know what's there, their resources. Yeah. And we were in a privileged position that we kind of knew all the forensic resources from, you know, cases you worked on or where we sat in head office, that the average detective isn't going to have access
to. And then courses we've done.
I
was checking yesterday how many courses I've done in my career. But before when he left, all the courses stopped.
Yeah.
There's no courses done by any member now after...
In our unit since we did. I mean,
so there's no longer that kind of week or 2 week annual forensic psychology.
No, it's still
that, but the specialized courses. That, I mean, Danny mentioned in the introduction interview we did with him a few weeks ago. He mentioned he went to the Miami to the medical legal. Oh, you're talking about
being able to get out of the country and to share and to get into the broader community around the world.
Even local stuff. I mean, we arranged here at the Bromfontein Forensic Pathology Service to have a week's worth of, forensic pathology training.
Yes. You know,
not to make us forensic pathologists, but also to understand what they're doing, what they're looking for, what is capable, what is possible, that even when we get to a scene, you have a bit of a better understanding that actually this might actually be this as opposed to that. Mm. Of course, you're going to confirm it with your other experts. But so local training we had here, but yes, the fantastic opportunities where we had chances to go overseas and get trained, like the Los Angeles Sheriff's Homicide course, or where we brought amazing trainers to come out here. I mean, bloodstained pattern analysis, which I was a very fortunate opportunity to do by one of the world's leading experts who came out here, which means at least on the scene, I understand the dynamics of the scene better. Like, that's actually a smear. Well, this is blood that was traveling in this direction. Hang on a minute. That's not mad. You know, it really just gives you better abilities to understand.
So none of that is happening currently.
Not like it was back then.
Not like it was.
And that's also partly there was a lot of money available for a certain period of time. Yeah. That, you know, extra budgets given by Parliament to SAPS. And where we had to, we're wasting it, but we had the ability to say, we want this really amazing training. This is the world's expert. And you go through processes and you bring that person out here. So.
And now that money gets spent on diesel for power stations.
Other things, you know, caravans for defense, for generals, apparently. I see the guy, they bought almost a R1 million caravan that a whole bunch of bases had to donate money for. Allegations, of course, at this point in time.
I
was reading that today. Okay. But I think, I mean, it's this hard work by a detective who knows what's out there, knows what he wants. A lot of detectives would have said, no, man, this is too vague. It's too much of maybe. But, you know, by hard work, you make maybe a reality.
Yeah.
By putting in the effort. But if you're going to always investigate by negative assumption, well, it's a Ray-Ban, lots of people have them, it's pointless. You know, well, we're never going to find anybody who would have seen anything. We're never going to... Then you can investigate a zero on any investigation very quickly, very easily.
There's a lot of cases where the people said, it was luck you found this. But I said, luck, you make your own luck. If you go and look for it, you must make your own luck.
You don't get lucky sitting in your office.
No. And go back to a crime scene. The body can be gone. It's no problem. Go check. Just go check for yourself what's going on there.
I mean, we had... was the highwayman. I went back after we got involved and I said to the detective, take it back. And then we searched a little bit further around the body and he's like, but here's an old handbag. Here's an old train ticket, you know? Yeah. So if you just go there, do the minimum, don't look broader.
It's also not I would imagine, it's not that you're, okay, now this case comes along that all day, every day, you've got to now be working really hard on this one case. It's about, in that initial period... Yes. Putting all your focus, attention, and really attending to as much of the micro detail as you can in those first 3 or 4 days, and setting the path for the investigation for the next 3 or 4 months, which will go, okay, so sunglasses. That's now part of this initial investigation, but now that's going to go, and it's going to, and I'm going to monitor that piece of evidence until it gives me something that I can apply to the case. So it's about a little bit of condensed work, and then let it, once you've set the tone, the case.
That's why murder. That's why murder robbery was so good, of the best units in South Africa years ago, because there were 10 guys on standby going to a crime scene. This one murder case, 10 guys will rock up on that crime scene. Then the commander will go through the crime scene and tell Gerard, this is your docket, so you know you must do all the paperwork.
Yeah,
you five guys out in the street, canvas
the neighbors.
You guys, you're doing this, you're doing the crime scene, and then 2-3 hours later come together, say, okay, this girl said she saw something, there's a camera there.
Yeah,
now one guy or two guys go to a murder crime scene.
Yeah.
That's just a big problem.
Mm. Yeah.
But I mean, I think there's another case we might discuss later where you say they decided to go check a local petrol station. And then they actually see that, hang on, there's this guy with this lady and the suspect and the victim. But they didn't describe that they had, you know. So those little things of, let me try. I mean, it might not work out, that's fine, but hell, it's amazing what you can find when you try.
Is that a challenge now because of the number of investigators that are available to go out and do stuff, or is it more about just the lack of good experience and lack of there hasn't been enough of it, there's been a bit of a brain drain and there's not been enough of a handing on of the right kind of knowledge. Or is it just numbers?
And you can give your thoughts, but I think it's a workload, yes, limited amount of people, but also had a lot to do with motivated to be doing the job. I have a commander who's going to be that mentor, checking if you've done it and suggesting things you can do that you might not have thought about if you're a newish kind of detective. And of course, the access to resources, is there forensics, is there DNA, how long is it going to take? So I think it's a mixture, but I think in the end, if you don't have a motivated cop, all your resources in the world mean absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
Mentorship, because that's why somebody must teach you from you can't go to a course and come back and you know anything.
Yeah. A detective course is a starting point of your detective career.
Yeah,
then your mentorship is, I think, very important.
Mm.
Talking about going back to a crime scene, that serial rape cases there in, we would GPS a crime scene. We know the suspect is driving a blue Toyota or something, and we're busy on the crime scene, and yes, the suspect driving past us.
Really? suddenly the detective who's taken us to this crime scenes, we're driving behind, and she suddenly just puts foot in, like, what? And we'd like chase after her, and the car had been seen.
Wow.
And we literally pulled him over, us or them and us, and arrested the suspect. Right then and there. It's like, so luck, but also if we hadn't been out there doing the GPSing, would we have been in that position?
You've got to put yourself in the way of good luck. Yeah. That's the bottom line.
That's the bottom line.
Unless you put yourself in the path of success, you won't find success. You need to put yourself in the right place.
Your eyes are closed and you're sleeping, you're going to miss everything.
Mm.
I'm quite curious. I mean, some of these cases obviously mean a lot to us personally and just because of our level of involvement and how it turned out. Did you keep contact? I mean, that's always an interesting question, because I've never really, very few people I've ever, from the victims and the family side, that I keep contact with. I mean, one has been Andrea Fenter. We discussed her case before, who was murdered. I've kept, over the years, contact with her dad.
Okay.
Mom passed away, and of course the suspect's mom I got to know very well, and every now and then send a message, how are you doing? Did you keep any contact with
them? Yes. I don't know why this case, but we still have contact each other still today.
I don't think it's a big surprise why, from my where I'm sitting. It's because it was I guess this just felt like a very personal case.
What
kind of responses do you get from family members when you've managed to solve a case for them? And it must be a very rewarding component.
It's rewarding if you can help them try to have some closure with it,
because you put up with so much cuck stuff.
And especially when you dealing lots of them, going back to them again, asking them questions again, so there is always a weird relationship with the victims' families.
Because, I mean, one is weird, because we're happy when we've caught the guy. We're excited, we're happy, we're elated. They're not necessarily going to be that happy. I think they are relieved, you know, but they're not happy.
And thankful.
They're not joyful.
Appreciative.
You know, it's like, it's almost like a sad thank you. Whereas us as cops, we've solved our case, you know, we're quite elated about it. So it's like, I thought you can understand why very often they're happy, but you're not a happy feature in their life.
No, of course not. I get that.
You know, and it's sometimes those special cases, like you say, where you still do have contact all these years. It's just those very rare cases where, you know.
Yeah, but I can imagine when it's not about somebody being happy. It's about a kind of affection, I suppose, that the family members would acquire, because you've come and been such a significant player in such a traumatic, difficult part of their life.
Absolutely.
You know, and just, and anyone that kind of contributes to closure, to a sense of justice, to a sense of creating some kind of takeaway that can allow you some kind of peace. The people responsible for that, you know, I can understand how that you must be held in very high regard by people who, you know, who you come across and whose lives you affect. So, you know, there you go. There's a good motivator, guys. If you want to get into law enforcement, you know, we're often talking about the hardships and the difficulties, especially in the context of the police today, but never forget that there, you know, knitted into this kind of work is a, you know, an ability to make a contribution to society that is really, really profound and meaningful. And the reward that you can take away from that, I can imagine, is, you know, it contributes to you living a pretty rewarding life, you know, even though you kind of, I'm sure that you struggle with bad pictures in your head sometimes.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I've had prosecutors who listen to these podcasts, and I'm sure there's cops out there. And it would be interesting if you are police or prosecutors actively serving and you listen to this, it'd be interesting to know, has it helped you? Has it made you think, you know, do you think it's improved your way that you would approach cases? It would be interesting to hear from people. I know Henry Horn, who won one of our previous competitions, he's actually, he was an aspirant prosecutor, newly appointed prosecutor going through the training. And I think he's now finished that and he's working in prosecuting. And once or twice he's told me, hey, I've got this, who should I speak to? And I've referred him on to Colonel Fechtenberg in the past. And it'd be interesting to hear from our listeners who are serving members of the law enforcement or prosecutions, what do you find value in these, in listening to these podcasts? It would just be interesting to see how that's maybe affected some people's work.
Absolutely. That would be nice.
For forensic pathologists
so we can feel some... So I can also share in this feeling like I can also take some reward out of I'm making some kind of a contribution to society,
absolutely,
to the world. I've got a hell of a lot of work to do to catch up with you two, though. That's the problem. You know what I want to ask before we wrap up today? What other cases, Yanni, do you envisage we can discuss in the future? Let's talk about some. Let's mark some future cases we can discuss in the minds of folks. What are some of the really interesting serial cases, maybe. Let's set up one or two.
Butterworth one for me, which is one that I wasn't really involved in, so you can really give
insight.
Which
one was that, sorry?
In the Eastern Cape, in a nutshell, what would you say?
The serial murder case in Butterworth was a village outside Butterworth, so 60 kilometers from Butterworth. I think it was 21 people was murdered there. Babies until old people.
Little small community. Literally a rural community in the Eastern Cape.
That's one we close off the whole community and took everybody's DNA.
We must definitely unpack that. Can we kind of like pencil you in for some future episodes where we can discuss some of your interesting cases? How does that sound?
That sounds good, thanks.
Okay, great. That would be awesome. Other than wrapping up now, do you have any other final comments that you want to make?
No, I think it's just again a great opportunity to hear from the people on the ground who are doing some amazing work over the years that we haven't been able to hear from because SAPS's reluctance to let people be interviewed.
It's nice to see you guys together again. Look, I mean, this is a bit of a kind of a work reunion, isn't it? I mean, we could call this work. You know, again, we're contributing to, we're sharing information and knowledge with people. Nice to see you guys back together. You guys must miss the days when you were running around the country,
for sure,
solving cases, getting into, you know, having briars.
Drinking lots of red wine.
Well, I'm glad we found a reason to bring you guys back together every now and again, around the stuff that kind of bonded you together in the first place. All right, well, thanks, guys. I mean, this was great. It was lovely to be able to kind of get into the. I always love getting into the detail of a case, and I'm sure our listeners do as well, where we can really kind of go through a case. And it's always interesting because inevitably in these cases we find these really unique pieces of evidence or these really unique directions that a case took that again shows what incredible investigators, what incredible minds, what great technology we have access to in the police. Unfortunately, right now it's all a little bit, it's not maybe as streamlined and as effective as and efficient as it could be, but I think these discussions remind us that there's always hope for law enforcement in South Africa, and that we do have a good skill set and cases do get solved well, and hopefully that can be more and more like the reality for us here in South Africa when it comes to law enforcement, that more of these kinds of cases and more of these kinds of investigations that are really successful are a part of the world we live in. I don't know. Thanks very much, guys. Yanni, it's always it's a pleasure as always to have you on the podcast. Gerard, thank you so much. Thank you very much, guys, and have a lovely rest of your day.
Thank you, you too.
And to all our listeners, rest easy.